From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As economists look ahead to the new year, their consensus is this: recovery depends upon the pandemic's end. Until then, they say, some sectors will continue to struggle, while others will manage to hang on, and some will even thrive. Also, the pandemic's economic fallout will continue to hit certain Americans harder than others: low-wage workers, people of color, women. Today in The Exchange, an economic forecast for the new year, including a look at the new coronavirus relief package. And Exchange listeners, we welcome your questions and comments. How did this past year's economic tumult affect you? And what's your own prediction for the new year in terms of the economy nationally and here in the state? Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 800-892-6477. Our guests are Bill Rogers. He's a professor of public policy and chief economist at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development, Rutgers University. Also, Phil Sletten, senior policy analyst at the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. Well, welcome both of you. Happy New Year. And before we look ahead, let's look back just a little bit about how the pandemic affected our economy last year. It's a complex picture. And Professor Rogers, you first. What's the big picture for you?
Sure. So prior to March and April, we were experiencing the best economy since World War II. Over 20 million jobs had been created. Unemployment had fallen to historic record lows. Wages were finally starting to stay ahead of inflation. And then the pandemic hit. And we basically, the government, since we hadn't experienced something like this in our lifetime, the government's first response was to shut the economy down. And so, you know, 20 to 30 million people are now filing for unemployment insurance. You also saw about 20 million jobs were lost in the private sector. And that's the economic toll. And then on the health toll, we saw, right, many communities who had not been part of the expansion were hit hard on an economic standpoint and a health standpoint.
Well, Professor Rogers, it's so striking to hear you say before the pandemic, we were in the best economy since World War II. What a dramatic slide, Professor Rogers, but it's been unequal, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And that's one thing that people will, you know, don't really talk about as much is that, yes, we were in this amazing economy, but economic inequality, which breeds economic insecurity, was at its highest level on record. And what I mean by economic insecurity, so in New Jersey, I've done some work with the United Way here, where we constructed an acronym called ALICE, where ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed. And in New Jersey, similar to many places throughout the United States, prior to the pandemic, even though great economy, we had about 38% of our households that were living at or below some living wage. And what that meant was they were having difficulty providing health care for their families. They were having difficulty providing child care for their families. They were having difficulty providing meeting their mortgages and their rent. So the picture looked great on one hand, but on the other hand, it was a recipe for disaster, and we've seen that disaster.
Well, Phil Sletten, what surprised you about the economic impact of this pandemic that Professor Rogers has described, about how it hit us here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so it's hard to overemphasize how both swift and severe this impact was. So if we think about the unemployment rate, the seasonally adjusted unemployment rate in New Hampshire, it went from 2.4% to 17.1% in 1 month.
Wow.
Which is a really dramatic change, especially if you look at how historically the unemployment rate has changed. And that was at the same time that people took themselves out of the labor force. A lot of people in that time also stopped participating. So they either had to stay home to care for someone or to care for a child who was home from school. So that translates into roughly between mid-February and mid-April, about one out of every five Granite Staters who had a job in February didn't have one in April. And that's a really massive change. And that's much more dramatic than, for example, the Great Recession of 2007, 2009. Some of your listeners might remember how dramatic the fall of 2008 in the middle of that recession, sort of the steepest part of the slide, felt. But at the height of unemployment in New Hampshire during the Great Recession, it peaked at about 6.5%, which is a lot lower than that 17.1% we saw in April of 2020. And the levels that we still saw in May and June, it's reduced since then, but it's really hard to overemphasize how dramatic this impact was.
So that's been the biggest surprise for you, Phil, just how swift all this change was?
Well, one of the surprises as well has been how quickly we've recovered, at least in the top line numbers. And that's an important caveat. So the unemployment rate has now fallen down to a seasonally adjusted 3.8% in New Hampshire in November. And that's quite the recovery. And people have been rejoining the labor force. Our labor force is still a fair bit smaller than it was prior to the pandemic. But it's important to remember how uneven these impacts were. So if we look at jobs that are that were typically high-wage jobs, there's been some research using some high-frequency data comparing what the number of jobs in New Hampshire is at a high wage, a medium wage, and a low wage relative to what we had in January. And high-wage jobs did see a dip, but they recovered relatively quickly, and they're actually a little bit above where we were in January. Middle wage jobs have recovered more slowly, and we've gotten back to about that point as of mid-October, but low wage jobs are still down about 20%, which really shows the split in terms of the economic impact here. Parts of the recovery have been moving along nicely, but other parts, especially for people who are the most vulnerable going into this recession, other parts have not seen very much of a recovery at all. And that's surprising because this does not look like a regular recession. And as a result, we've seen some really interesting and sometimes very troubling things in the economic data.
Well, and I know, Professor Rogers, you've been looking at this as well. You know, those categories of workers who've really been struggling, those categories of workers who are doing okay. I want to ask you about a particular category of workers, Professor Rogers. The last recession was often called a man session because it hit those jobs traditionally dominated by men, construction and manufacturing and so forth. This one's been called a she session. Why is that?
And the person or colleague who coined that phrase, Nicole Mason, she's the CEO, president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. And she and others noticed that because so many of the jobs that were shut down or the industries that were shut down were restaurants, hospitality, education. These are industries that have a larger percentage of women in them. And so as we turn the spigot off, so to speak, with the economy, with economic activity, particularly because of the focus on these industries and occupations that you might call high touch or where you're in close proximity to people, where you are touching similar things, or you're in enclosed spaces, that women and also the minorities especially saw their unemployment rates and their participation. Unemployment rates jump the most, but also their participation rates fall the most. One of the most striking and shocking things for me was we've worked so hard to increase the participation of women in our society over the last 4 to 5 decades, and to see it fall below 50% for the first time since World War II was quite shocking. The good news is that, as Phil was saying, we have had some of a modest recovery for certain groups, and those participation rates for women have risen back above 50%, but they're still well below where we were last year in March and April.
So high-touch industries, Professor Rogers, would be what, like hairdressers?
Hairdressers, yeah. Waiters, waitresses, well, the industry would be restaurants, hospitality, hotels, retail, right? That's what I mean by high touch, or just really high, or have greater incidence or chance of, right, transmission of the virus.
Yeah, and you really can't cut somebody's hair from home, so or at least you can try, but I'm not sure how it might come out.
Telehealth, and I guess it'd be tele cosmetology.
Yeah, I've just chosen to let mine go, but that's another topic. I
I'm
want to
sorry.
remind listeners that you can join us with your own economic forecast for the new year. You know, given all the uncertainties around the pandemic, can we even make those predictions, listeners? We really want to hear from you this morning. Also, just tell us how you fared economically last year, what your hopes are for this year. Our number here on the Exchange, 800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Once again, exchange at nhpr.org. So here's a comment from Andy in Albany. He's a camp director there. He wrote to our coronavirus survey and tells us about his experience. He says, we were able to rely on government programs and the largesse of our supporters to get through last summer. If next summer is significantly limited, as I expect it will be, I'm afraid those sources of support won't be as dependable. I'd love to hear from you, Phil Sletten, on that. You know, the summer camp industry, very important here in New Hampshire. Summer recreation, very important here in New Hampshire. But New Hampshire's recreation industry has had sort of a mixed year last year. In some instances, it was quite strong, Phil.
Yeah, it's one of these interesting things that we're seeing where there are people who are able to go out, who have the disposable income, and who are perhaps taking more vacations locally than they would have otherwise. And a lot of people were finding new activities to try and, in response to the pandemic, in response to the public health limitations on socializing to prevent the spread of the virus. One of the things that we've seen that's particularly interesting is that there's been these different areas of impact that are really dependent on factors that we haven't typically had to think about when we're thinking about what's happening to the economy, what's happening to these different parts of these different industries. So one indicator that I'll point to when it comes to tourism in New Hampshire is the meals and rentals tax revenue receipts. So this is a tax that New Hampshire levies. It's the second largest tax that New Hampshire levies and actually collects the revenue from. That is on restaurant meals primarily. That's about 80% of the tax base, as well as hotel rooms and rental cars that are rented in the state. And we've seen that one dip quite a bit. We saw it really take a dip at the beginning of the year or at the beginning of the pandemic. But then it actually overperformed expectations a little bit. And a lot of that is likely to do to outdoor dining, including maybe people who were recreating in New Hampshire and who live in a more densely populated area going to these establishments that have set up outdoor dining operations. So there's some innovation there that has likely led to those tax revenues coming in a little better than was sort of initially feared at the beginning of the pandemic. However, those revenues overall are still a ways down from where they were expected to be.
Yeah, a real mixed bag. And next week, we're going to do a whole show on the outdoor recreation industry here in New Hampshire, changes and some expansion, as you're alluding to, Phil. But for summer camps, when kids are, you know, coming up and living there for 2 weeks or a month, it's been a struggle. And we're all hoping that this thing turns around so that those summer camps can open, because boy, the kids need them. Here's another comment that we got on our coronavirus survey about another hard hit sector. This is from Megan in Keene. Megan says, many of my friends in the music, entertainment, and restaurant industries have experienced setbacks that I did not. They continue to be affected 9 months later. We need a stronger government and community response to support families and individuals facing hardship due to this virus. Professor Rogers, here in New Hampshire, I've heard of restaurants really adapting and trying new ways of reaching customers, trying to stay afloat. What innovations have you seen in this especially hard-hit sector, Professor Rogers, the restaurant sector?
I think one for me has, and it's really been more of a diffusion or a spread, and that is seeing smaller mom-and-pop type restaurants, your Main Street type restaurants, really learning how to apply the technology so they can do, they've been able to do like curbside or on-site pickup with their meals or for their meals and their products. That's been one for me. I think, you know, another area has been also figuring out how to utilize space more efficiently, particularly outdoor space. So in New York, there's some of these wider streets that is where the area would be on the for parking. In many places have created nice little almost like little kiosks or roadside stands that have roofs and on them, and then there's some interesting architecture and design, and then also just decorating them with plants and other other images. And so that's from a standpoint of restaurant, that's kind of where I some of the things I've seen.
I want to again remind listeners that you can also fill out our coronavirus survey at nhpr.org like those listeners did, and just let us know how this pandemic is affecting you. You can also send us an email right now. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call. We want your own economic forecasts for the new year. Also, tell us how you fared economically last year. Here's an email from a listener, Professor Rogers, I'll throw this to you, who says, please don't forget the impact of childcare or the lack thereof on women, even in two-parent households. Is there data to support the anecdotes I've heard of moms being predominantly the ones to step back from work to handle childcare or remote school? I'm so glad this listener wrote. Go ahead, Professor Rogers.
Yeah, I wanted to add when I talked about earlier that this has been viewed as a she session, and the job losses and the contraction in the economy have had a greater impact on women, and one of the extensions or the impacts of that has been the challenge of childcare, particularly in those early months when we just didn't understand the virus and its transmission. Dual households, single parent households, we're seeing. We all were. I have adult children, and I was having to work through issues around childcare because two of them came home, and were living with me, and fortunately they were able to keep their jobs. They had their jobs, and they've been doing quite well. But for the typical American, again, I want to provide that juxtaposition. Prior to the pandemic, when one of the reasons why, even though we were seeing this a great economy, we were seeing actually an increase in the share of ALIF households, again, where ALIF stands for Asset Limited Income Constrained and Employed. And these are the families that don't have enough money to meet all their expenses each month. And one of the big expenses they were having difficulty with meeting prior to the pandemic was childcare. That there's been this continued rising cost of childcare. And so just as many of us have learned that the pandemic has shown the vulnerabilities in the healthcare system, the pandemic has shown the vulnerabilities in our childcare system. And because of the aging of the population, it's also showed our vulnerabilities in our elder care.
Oh, sure. Lots of vacancies there. Yeah, people really.
And that's right. So I'm totally agree with your viewers or your listeners' sentiment that, and there have been studies that have shown that women in particular, and moms in particular, have been the ones who've had to take on a greater share of the burden, and that's partly too why we saw their participation rates or their participation shares fall during this pandemic.
So Phil, here's a look ahead question for you. Given the shortages that we've seen in childcare workers and I'm so glad Professor Rogers mentioned this, in long-term care facilities, given those shortages, given that those roles are often filled by female workers, given that, as we were hearing, some female workers are saying, I can't handle the at-home school challenge and I can't work right now. Where are those workers going to come from, Phil, to fill those critical childcare slots and those long-term care slots?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And we've certainly seen at the national level, women, particularly women with children, have seen their labor force participation rate drop more. And to the extent that in New Hampshire, is that dependent on whether schools are open for in-person learning or not? And if it is dependent in part on that, then we can see that maybe some of those folks will come back to the labor force and re-engage and fill some of those important positions. That being said, a lot of our labor force participation drop may have also been because there were people who decided to retire early. New Hampshire is a somewhat older state. We have a fair number of folks who are in that sort of 55 to 75 age group in New Hampshire. And for people, especially who are maybe close to what they were thinking about for retirement age, this pandemic hits, they leave their job or they become unemployed. how many of them are then essentially going to retire, or how many of them are able to retire is obviously one of the questions, whether they're financially able to or not. But if they are, or if they're even close, how many of them are at the point where they say, I was in the labor force, I don't think that I'm going to be able to find a job on the other side, or they look for a job and can't find a job, at least that matches what they're looking for on the other side of this crisis, or as the economic recovery picks up. So that is a key variable in my mind.
Here's a big question I wanted to ask both of you. You know, every year we here on The Exchange do a show like this in January, you know, looking ahead at the economy in the new year. And Professor Rogers, no offense to economists, of course, but given what we've seen last year, what's the value of even spending time trying to predict the course of economic events this year? Or is it just totally unpredictable?
Well, I wouldn't throw the profession, and particularly a narrow segment of the profession under the bus. I think that, I think that there's information to be had out there, and the challenges with COVID is that the estimates or the forecasts that people are predicting or generating, they have a wide dispersion, right? There's so much uncertainty still. There's wide dispersion, but it is kind of amazing though when you look at what's happened on the stock market and even on Main Street, even with this with this greater uncertainty, which makes it harder to plan. As you mentioned earlier, there's been some pretty amazing innovation, or been some amazing kind of responses in terms of trying to move forward. And so, forecasts are what they are. They're forecasts, but they do contain information in them. And I think as we've moved into January and February, that uncertainty is hopefully going to start to get smaller. Why is that? One, the vaccine now is starting to be distributed more widely. And also there's been a change in administration. I don't mean to be political here, but the president or the exiting president has created a lot of unnecessary uncertainty in the eyes, in the minds of people on Main Street and on Wall Street. So that's going to be, I think the Biden administration is going to be very different in that regard, in terms of generating unnecessary anxiety and uncertainty amongst on Main Street and Wall Street. And then also we finally got through our last major holiday, which is all about, right, family and friends and gathering. And so the next 2 weeks will be, going according to the public health officials, the next 2 weeks will be also, right, very important in terms of giving us an indication as to how much of a spike upward we're going to see in the virus and hence sicknesses.
Sure. Once again, highlighting the absolutely firm link between the pandemic and the economy. And I'm glad you mentioned Wall Street too. I was reading this morning, stocks ended the year 15% higher despite 20 million people unemployed. So there's that like split economy that we're talking about. Phil, how about you? I mean, everything's so crazy and hard to predict. Is it even worth trying to predict the economy in 2021?
And I think the fact that things are so bizarre and out of the norm, it makes it that much more important to look at these data and to really try to understand what they're telling us and to try and understand what's going on out in the economy, connecting it to the data, what's happening in people's lives. And really looking at that, trying to understand what are some of the scenarios, what are some of the things that we should be prepared for. That's obviously, there are public health questions associated with that. There are economic questions. And really trying to make sure that when we are thinking about public policy going forward, that those public policies are informed by the data, informed by the information, and really try to help a lot of the people who are really the most vulnerable, a lot of the people who are among the most vulnerable coming into this recession as a result of this recession, and maybe among the most vulnerable coming out of this recession as well, depending on what the economic recovery looks like. Trying to understand what's happening in the economy is very important to getting some of those public policy decisions right, or at least understanding what the range of possibilities are that those that a lot of those public policies and a lot of businesses, a lot of individuals may have to tackle going into what will hopefully then be an economic recovery following this crisis.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned public policy, Phil. Perfect segue for me to say that after a break, we're going to get your thoughts on the new economic relief package from Congress, what policies are included in that to help boost the economy as it moves through, you know, what will hopefully be the last part of the pandemic. We've got another economist joining us as well after our break from Dartmouth College. So all that's coming up, plus more of your emails. Keep them coming in. exchange@nhpr.org. You can call us too, 800-892-6477.
As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for NHPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, Managing Director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of NHPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that NHPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's an economic forecast for the new year, including a look at the new coronavirus relief package. And listeners, what is your prediction for the economy in 2021? How did your industry or your own workplace fare last year? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. Again, 800-892-6477. We're talking with Professor Bill Rogers, an economist at Rutgers University, also Phil Sletten from the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, and joining us now is Patricia Anderson, economics professor at Dartmouth College. Professor Anderson, welcome to The Exchange. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've written and talked a lot, Professor Anderson, about a K-shaped recovery that we're in now. Recognizing that it's radio, make it crystal clear, what is that K-shaped recovery all about?
So I think it helps to back up and talk about a V-shaped recovery. The collapse was so sudden that a lot of people thought, well, as soon as pandemic is over, which at the beginning people thought was maybe only a few months, everything will bounce back. This is a temporary economic shock. And so we'll have this big drop in economic activity, and then it'll shoot back up and look like a V. And so that was sort of the initial hope. And for the sort of higher skilled workers, higher economic status families, that's more or less been true. You can work from home, you can keep getting paid. There's not a lot to spend your money on. And so they're just really doing quite well. But for the less skilled workers who can't do their jobs at home, things, you know, and the restaurant workers and things that really have been impacted by the pandemic, things have not gone so well. And so they've sort of stayed low and in some cases gotten worse. A lot of these temporary layoffs have become permanent. And so you've got the top half looks like a V, but the bottom is still sort of falling out for a good number of families.
So what's your prediction?
Looking more like a K.
Yeah, Professor Anderson, what's your prediction for this K? I'm trying to picture it in my mind about how it will look, you know, 6 or 8 months from now in the new year.
So, I mean, my hope is that the vaccine actually gets distributed well and it continues to work. And the key part is people's fears have to go away. A lot of the economic collapse wasn't purely from sort of the actual shutdowns. It was people being unwilling to go to a movie theater, to go to a restaurant, to travel. And so the hope is that if people feel like, okay, the risk is over, a lot of people, particularly in that upper end, will have a lot of pent-up demand, and hopefully we'll be going to the restaurants, we'll be traveling, and all the folks on the lower end of the K will get jobs back, and, you know, we'll be smoking, as it were. But,
yeah.
You know.
The roaring 20s all over again, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully without the crash at the end, Professor Anderson.
Yeah.
So I want to bring in our other guests as well as we talk about public policy. And all of you have described pretty much the same thing, this economy, this K-shape, where the sort of upper income, highly educated workers who can work from home are doing pretty well. So their economic fortune is the upward part of the K, and people who work in lower wage, lower skilled jobs, especially those hands-on jobs that Professor Rogers talked about at the lower end of the K, going down or struggling. How does, Professor Anderson, you first, please, how does the most recent relief package from Congress address these inequities that you've talked about?
Not great. It does expand unemployment insurance, which is good for the folks that are still without jobs. But a lot of the people that are struggling have low wage jobs. And so they're not benefiting from the UI packages that were part of this new program or from the CARES Act. And so, you know, they did benefit a little from the $1,200 from the initial one. You know, the $600 will help now, but it's not very targeted. And, you know, the $2,000 they're talking about in a lot of ways is sort of a waste of money because it's just kind of a money drop on, I think I've read 75% or more, maybe it's more, a huge fraction of the populace that's on the upper part of the K that doesn't need that much money. And so you can probably do a better job of targeting the programs that that lower end needs.
So unemployment insurance isn't the gold standard here, Professor Anderson, for people who are struggling?
Well, it's great if you're unemployed, but I think there's a lot of people that are struggling with their low-wage jobs that they have to continue to do. And in fact, were maybe never unemployed. They worked at a grocery store or some other essential. They're a custodian at a hospital, et cetera.
Yeah. How about you, Professor Rogers? What's your sort of overall grade or take on the relief package that we saw signed at the end of the year?
It's probably, I would say, it's in the sort of a B to C, C plus range.
Wow. Underwhelming, yeah. Professor Rogers.
Well, that's probably one of the lowest grades I've given anybody, including my students, over the last few semesters. But seriously, the reason why is that, you know, as Patty was saying, and is that there's the sort of, it's not targeted well, it's not been timely, and it's just too temporary. That that the typical family, when you use, there's some great government data that's underutilized called the Consumer Expenditure Survey, and when looking at that information over the most recently, you know, families up to like households are up to like with about $50,000, they do not have discretionary income. They're actually, even after taxes and support from the government, again prior to the pandemic, right, they're actually spending more than their income or the support that they get. And then if you go from like $50,000 to $75,000, these are people who have their incomes do exceed their expenditures, but there's not a lot of wiggle room. There's not a lot of ability to be able to withstand that unexpected paycheck, unexpected expense. Prior to the pandemic, I believe the Federal Reserve has done another great survey where they were finding, and been quoted by a lot of people, like about 38% to 39% of Americans' households, if they had an unexpected bill of $400, they couldn't meet it. And so we're in the midst of this pandemic where people have been pulled their resources have been pulled down and dwindling and drying up. And so, you know, the reason why I give such a low grade is that it doesn't provide the timely, and it's also the targeting of the resources or the support is very small. And then just one other point on the policy as to why I have major problems with this round is that from a state like New Jersey, where our state budgets have been whacked like many others, and here's another set of essential workers that are potentially going to be harmed we're putting them in harm's way, not unnecessarily, and those are our first responders, our teachers, right, state and local employees, and so there's no support or relief in this latest round, and hopefully when Biden and Vice President-elect Harris take office, that we will see a new round, and we will see something that will be better targeted, more timely, and it'll be appropriately in the right amount of temporariness.
Well, and Phil Sutton, I've seen lots of headlines towards the end of the year saying $2 billion, I think it was, coming to New Hampshire from this stimulus package. So sounds pretty good. Where and how might it help, Phil?
Yeah, so I want to highlight for folks who are, as Professor Rogers identified, who may not have, you know, even enough money to absorb a $400 expense in there that's unexpected. And indeed, a fair number of people who are having trouble paying their bills on a regular basis, the additional unemployment insurance benefits. And I also want to point out the expanded SNAP benefits, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as the food stamp program. Those are things that not only provide money directly to folks who are having trouble making ends meet, who are having trouble paying those monthly bills, especially during a pandemic, where a lot of folks who are impacted are people who really didn't see their real wages grow until the very tail end of the economic recovery in New Hampshire. You know, their real purchasing power was not growing for much of this record long economic expansion that we've had in the United States. It really was only in the last several years that in New Hampshire we saw those wages go up and that purchasing power increase. So those expanded unemployment compensation benefits and the SNAP benefits, the food stamp benefits, those have been shown to be economically effective broadly. So if a study from the last recession looking at the first quarter of 2009 found that an increase like we saw in this federal aid package, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that for every dollar invested in it generated $1.74 of economic activity. So that's something that it's not just aid specifically to folks who are having trouble making ends meet. It is very much that, but it is also an overall economic stimulant. It is something that gets money into the local economy in New Hampshire.
And that's interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and I would also flag the rental assistance. New Hampshire, this is one area where we've seen, and we've heard it many times on this show, Laura, the housing crisis in the state, the real housing shortage that is in New Hampshire, both in terms of purchasing homes and on the rental market. New Hampshire is set to receive at least around $200 million is the minimum, I believe, in this package for each state. And New Hampshire is set to receive about that much for rental assistance. And also there's the extension of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's eviction moratorium. So that helps people stay in their homes. That helps people pay their landlords. That helps put more money in the economy in a direct way, and in a way that really helps the financial stability of individuals. Alongside these SNAP benefits, alongside expanded unemployment compensation, those really, because they're benefiting folks who really didn't see as much wage growth or didn't see their real wages go up to pre-Great Recession levels and the recovery from that, that helps lift economic fortunes broadly.
So Professor Anderson, we interviewed the head of the New Hampshire Food Bank around the holidays last year, and she said demand was up 50%, which is just incredible. What's the connection, Professor Anderson, between food assistance and overall economic recovery?
So I think it's big. You know, you obviously need food to live. That's
right.
A surprise. But you need to feel secure to be, you don't want to get depressed and not want to go to work. But just broadly speaking, as you know, Phil was saying, you know, people forget that SNAP is spent at the local grocery stores, right? So people are bringing their demand to the grocery stores, etc. The food bank, a lot of that food comes sometimes from agricultural supports. Part of what got food stamps approved way back in the war on poverty was that it was really partly an agricultural support program. It helped farmers, and so you could get the rural states on board with helping out sort of urban poverty. And so it has bigger effects. If you really want to go long term, there's studies that show, having better food support for small children makes them more productive when they're adults, and hence helps the economy, 30 years later.
Yeah, that's so important. When children's brains are developing, they need proper nutrition so that they can do better, as you said. It sounds so fundamental. Professor Anderson, but there it is. What else do you think, Professor Anderson, should be in this bill? The three of you have sort of talked about pieces that you like, but pieces that are missing. So what else should be in it, Professor Anderson, in your opinion?
So first, I have to agree with Bill that, you know, there needs to be some support for states. Unlike the Fed, states have to balance their budget. And
right.
So there's going to be some hard times coming if they've got to lay off a lot of workers to balance their budget or cut support programs that have been, you know, working so well, you know, the types of things Phil was talking about. So I think I've got to agree with that. You've got to put that in. I mean, part of the problem is things that I would like end up becoming technologically difficult, and in the sense of wanting to target workers better. And so, you know, the UI top-offs, you know, worked out really great for those who were unemployed. You know, in New Hampshire, for example, if you were a full-time worker under the original CARES Act, I think you could have been making up to about $25 an hour and have gotten full replacement of your wages. Whereas, you know, you had grocery store workers who were probably making, you know, $15 an hour and exposing themselves to COVID risk.
Right, showing up every day, sure.
And so, you know, some way to provide some sort of top off to the people that have been working at these lower wages. There was some for healthcare workers in the first bill, but really nothing for these, you know, everyday essential workers that we're interacting with. And so some way to target this group that's had to work the whole time at lower wages than people that were unemployed, I think would be nice.
Yeah, lower wages and higher risk for some of these workers, like grocery store workers, as you said, Professor Anderson. Also, I remember at the state level, there was some sort of temporary cash bonus for people who worked at long-term care mm-hmm. facilities. And that gets to my last question for you, Professor Anderson. We've talked a lot about federal policies. What about state-level policies? What state-level policies do you think are helpful, Professor Anderson, or harmful?
Good
question. Big question. we could spend a whole hour on that, but go ahead.
So, you know, states obviously know what their needs are. So New Hampshire probably could use, you know, fuel assistance programs that, you know, Alabama doesn't need. They don't have people needing to buy oil in the winter. You know, so a lot of just sort of the general support programs that states know what it is their states need, you know, but again, do they have enough money to do it given they have to balance their budgets? And so technically unemployment insurance programs are run by the state. They set their own rules. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, New Hampshire, I think, did a pretty good job of getting the special pandemic UI running pretty quickly. What you saw in the sort of statistics is in New Hampshire, claims really jumped up quickly, but then came down faster than the US. And part of that was that they were ready to sort of handle them. So, you know, I'm kind of at a loss of knowing exactly what each state should do.
Yeah, each state is so different.
But I do believe that states, exactly.
Well, Professor Anderson, we'll talk to you again. It's been really good to have you on the show today. Thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Happy New Year. That's Patricia Anderson, professor of economics at Dartmouth College. So coming up, our guests will give us their hopes for the economy in the new year. Got a bunch more emails, too, that I'd like to share with you. You can email us your predictions for the economy in 2021 or tell us how you fared in 2020. It's exchange@nhpr.org. You can also call 800-892-6477. More in a moment. As
as a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, a New Year's economic forecast. We're looking ahead to what 2021 might bring for both the New Hampshire and national economy. And listeners, it's been great to hear from you. Tell us what your economic hopes or plans are for the new year, and what's your own prediction for the economy here in our state. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, comment on Facebook, or call 800-892-6477. We've been talking with economist and public policy professor Bill Rogers from Rutgers University and Phil Sletten from the New Hampshire Institute for Fiscal Policy. And Professor Rogers, beyond economic relief, recovery, you've been writing and speaking about what you call economic reimagination when the pandemic is behind us. Now, this is also whetting my appetite for a whole show on economic reimagination. But what are the broad outlines of that, Professor Rogers?
Sure. If I can, before answering that, I would love to just, I want to touch on something that Patty and Phil were talking about with regards to policy, and it will connect to reimagination.
The state level policies, yeah.
State and national. But sure. And I totally agree that SNAP and the unemployment insurance, they have a stimulative effect. But I guess the concern I have with this recent round, is that it's just too small. We know we're going to have several more months of hard times for families on Main Street and for businesses on Main Street. So why pass something that's only going to help us for another month, help families for another month or two? That's to help remove the uncertainty or lessen the uncertainty for families and for Wall Street. Let's go big and do something that will help get us that bridge, that span of the bridge into March and April. And so the problem I have with this this approach has been, and this connect, we'll start to build the reimagination conversation, is that because we've seen this recent spike up in infections and increases in deaths and greater stress, renewed stress on health our health system, we've shifted back from really doing recovery work that we're doing a lot of relief work. So the first part of reimagining the economy is, instead of being incremental and reactive, let's be proactive with our public policy responses to the pandemic. Because there in New Jersey, I serve on the governor's commission on restart and reopening. And our mantra is, if we can get the public health, if we can solve the pandemic, the public health problem, we'll get that addressed, that will create economic health. And then so we can be focused on recovery. And now the reimagination gets at what I talked about earlier in the hour. We went into this pandemic, the highest levels of income inequality on record, which translate into greater economic insecurity. And so what we need, part of the reimagination piece is addressing systemic sexism in the labor market, providing better child care and elder care opportunities and options, and also in the light of the murder of George Floyd, addressing systemic racism. Because the pandemic, it really blew open the door on the systemic, the structural, the scaffolding, the problems that we have in our society. And so reimagination is having a recovery that is truly jointly shared. And reimagination is investing in what the United Nations calls human priorities. That is, along with education and training, human capital, we're also investing in what we call social capital. We're investing in schools, we're investing in communities and helping them function better, helping reduce the risk that individuals have grown and families have been facing over the last 30 to 40 years.
Well, Tana wrote us an email that folds into what you're talking about, Professor Rogers, reimagination. Tana says, COVID-19 has exposed the fragility and inequality in our healthcare, economic, and caregiving systems. Women are predominantly on the front lines of the pandemic, shouldering the burdens in the workplace and at home as caregivers to children and aging parents. Tana says women make up the majority of healthcare and frontline workers, 78%, and have disproportionately suffered negative health and economic consequences. Tana says going forward, we must recognize that as we begin to rebuild our economy and our community, we must do better for women and families. Tana, thank you for writing. And Phil Sletten, I'd love to hear from you too on this concept of economic reimagination for our economy here in the state.
Yeah, I know that when I'm looking at economic data this coming year, I'm going to be looking for the building blocks for a broad, inclusive, and sustainable economic recovery. Going into this crisis, it's worth emphasizing that there were a lot of people who did not have the financial resiliency to go into this crisis, and they were among the people who were most dramatically impacted by this. Again, the economic recovery that we just experienced prior to the pandemic hitting was the longest in recorded U.S. history. But even though the recession ended in 2009, it wasn't really until 2015 or 2016 that we saw median wages and median incomes in New Hampshire start to rise in an inflation-adjusted manner and get back. Really, only in 2018 and 2019 did we see wages get back to their pre-recession levels. So that means a lot of people were going into this crisis in a financially fragile state. Mm-hmm. And that also has, there's also disproportionate impacts there. That recovery didn't reach everyone in equal fashion. So for example, women had a slightly higher poverty rate in New Hampshire than men in the period immediately leading up to the pandemic. The poverty rate for Granite Staters identifying as Hispanic or Latino was about twice as high as the statewide average. And it was more than twice as high than the statewide average for Granite Staters who were Black or African American. So this recovery provides sort of an opportunity to learn the lessons from the last recovery and really try and understand what are the public policies, what are the economic factors that could support a broader and more inclusive economic recovery and really support a lot of the wages and the financial conditions for people at the low end of the income spectrum. Because we saw that in the recovery that we just, in the recovery from the Great Recession, we saw the economy really start to pick up when wage growth was more robust at the low end of the income spectrum. And of course, that's a positive feedback loop. Faster economic growth helps that, but also that lower wage growth helps economic recovery happen faster and for more people.
So Phil, in the short term, the next, let's just say 3-4 months, what numbers will you be tracking, Phil? What trends will you be looking at to let you know how the economy is going to do in the new year?
Right, so I will be looking at, there are some really interesting indicators that we've collected over the course of this pandemic that have sort of popped up in response to the rapid economic changes. So for example, between mid-March and mid-July, we know from what the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey that nearly half of Granite State households lost employment income during that time period. To the extent that indicators like that are things that can be carried forward, you know, what is the difficulty of people to pay expenses in that Household Pulse Survey, if that continues, that's one that I'm going to be watching. The most recent data suggests it's about 1 in 3 people have in New Hampshire have difficulty paying for usual household expenses in the last 7 days.
Wow, that's a lot, Phil, because yes. We're a relatively wealthy state per capita anyway.
Right. And the problem with these newer data sets is we don't really have a comparison to the immediate prior period. But yes, 1 in 3 households in late November and early December indicated that paying for usual household expenses was difficult. So I'll be watching indicators like those to the extent those are carried forward into the recovery. I'll also be watching the number of people employed. So not just what the unemployment rate is, but how many people are actually employed and how that interacts with the number of people who are in the labor force in New Hampshire. And also wages, particularly wages for low-wage workers and poverty rates to see not just how they're changing in aggregate, but how they're changing for different groups and for different people in New Hampshire and different areas of New Hampshire as well.
How about you, Professor Rogers? Are there one or two sort of trends or numbers that you're going to be keeping an eye on that'll give you a clue at least as to how the economy will do in 2021?
I'll be following all the the items that that Phil mentioned. I think one group that I'm have written about for the Century Foundation with Richard Freeman, colleague, that I'll be following is young people. Because of the nature of this pandemic and its effect on the economy, so much of our response, policy response, has been about saving the economy, and that totally makes sense. But one of the big problems with that approach is by not putting a lot of emphasis on young people. So when I say 16 to, young people, I'm saying 16 to 24 years of age, particularly those who've just graduated from college or graduated from high school and they're not going to continue their education. There's ample research and evidence that have shown that whenever we get youth who come into an economy, when there's been a downturn, their long-term economic prospects suffer. Many of them do not see their earnings or their incomes recover or catch up. And so, we're seeing that damage that, even though the national unemployment rate has fallen back below 10%, the unemployment rate for young workers, particularly those with the least amount of education and those who are kids of color, young people of color, their unemployment rates are still in excess of 10%. And that's just the official unemployment rate. It doesn't include those who are working part-time but want to work full-time. It doesn't include those who have stopped searching for a job, but if offered a job, they take it. So, the youth or our young individuals, they're our future. And that's a part of the reimagination process.
Wow. So looking again at high school and college graduates, how they're going to make their way in this economy, especially given all that's going on. This has been great. And we could have talked a lot longer, but we'll cut it off there. And Professor Rogers, it's really nice to have you back on the show. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Bill Rogers. He's a professor of public policy and chief economist at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. Phil Sletten, great to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laura. It was great to be here.
That's Phil Sletten, senior policy analyst at the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. And today's show was produced by Exchange producer Jane Vaughn. Thanks for being with us, everybody. I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.